Our final speaker this morning before we move on to the Q&A is Dr. Karen Brazel. Dr. Brazel is professor of surgery at the Oregon Health Sciences University and is a general and trauma surgeon and also a program director. She's going to speak on the principles of education assessment. Karen?
Thanks, Mark. I'm going to take a little bit of a different tack and talk about some of the theory. And for those of you who have done the new continuous certification, hopefully you'll recognize that it to a large degree follows well-established principles of education and assessment. I don't have any financial disclosures, but I will tell you I have also drunk the Kool-Aid. I was a part of the board when we made the decision to go to this new continuous certification and pledged to take the continuous certification. I have signed up, but I will admit that it's on my list of things to do this weekend. I haven't yet quite done it. I'm going to talk about questions, and I'm going to talk about questions from an assessment standpoint and remind everybody that assessment really has kind of two lanes, if you will. There's formative assessment, how we use questions to learn, and summative assessment. And more, if I could wrap things up with the one thing I'd like you to take away, is that those two are converging and recognizing that formative assessment really is by far the most important type of assessment. It does give an idea of what you know, but it also helps you learn. And if you think about the data that say it takes 17 years to get much of what you have spent today, yesterday, learning, it takes 17 years to get a study into actual practice, from the point of view of really changing things, doing good for patients, as Dr. Freischlag talked about, we really need a way to get that out there sooner. And so formative assessment that is somewhat standardized is one way to do that. There's a question hierarchy. I'm going to go through a few different ways to think about questions, that you may take as someone who is learning, but also questions you may use to teach patients, to teach students, to teach medical students. And the hierarchy goes from remembering is the lowest point on the hierarchy to creating, and that's the highest point on the hierarchy. And as we are either trying to teach or assess people going through a particular subject, the more experienced the person is, the more you want to get at the top of that learning platform, the more you need to be asking questions that are higher on this hierarchical ladder. This is the first three are characterized as really low on the ladder, and the last three are higher. Most of us make the mistake of thinking that application questions are on the higher aspect or higher order questions, and it turns out that those really don't delve deep into somebody's knowledge. And the mistake that we make as assessors is that about 70% of the questions that we ask are on the low part of this ladder, and meaning that 30% of questions are on the higher aspect of this ladder. It's not to say that questions on the low part of the ladder aren't important. If you can't remember something, if you can't understand something, then it's hard to evaluate it. It's hard to be creative about it. It just means that if you're trying to assess really true higher order thought, we need to be a little further up the ladder or down the list, if you will. This is another way to classify questions. You can ask questions about a subject matter. So you might ask about anatomy or physiology. You might specifically ask about sepsis. then that you can ask about a personal response. So what is your experience with taking care of patients with hernia, inguinal hernia, a ventral hernia, an incisional hernia? You might ask questions about the external environment. So what are the current guidelines about taking care of somebody who is delirious in the intensive care unit? In this way of classifying questions, the way to get at higher order thought is to ask in the areas that overlap in this Venn diagram. So if you're asking enriched questions that intersect the subject matter in a personal response, those are higher order questions. And the highest order in this circles classification is asking dense questions that incorporate aspects of the external environment, a personal response, personal experience, and subject matter. So again, if we want to really probe, really get at how well you understand something or teach something that is likely to have to do with judgment, the questions need to be in this enriched or dense, indensed area. And then lastly, this is just another way to categorize factual, conceptual, procedural, and metacognitive. And again, the further you go down the higher order, the more you're testing judgment, the more I would argue these are the areas that we need to be in for continuous certification rather than just factual questions or, as I think Julie said, gotcha questions. And that was on Pat's slide as well. So factual questions might be anatomy questions or the percent non-operative failure if you're talking about management of splenic injury. Conceptual questions, tell me how you're going to approach this patient with an incarcerated hernia that's recurrent now twice, the similarities and differences between two approaches, different ways to treat, the advantage of a four-port versus a three-port lap chole, and then metacognitive, asking somebody how well they did, given your assessment of how well you did, how might you improve? So if we take take an inguinal hernia, if we look at question hierarchy, the most common type, that would be remembering. Where does the hernia occur would be remembering and understanding. The approach would be applying. What would you do if you found necrotic bowel? What would you do if it was a femoral hernia would be analyzing. Now we're in the higher order from that initial hierarchy. Then evaluating how well you thought you did, and would you change anything next time you saw this patient? So you can see how this might play out in your practice. You can see how this might play out in asking questions in a continuous certification mode. So knowledge dimensions, same question list, factual questions, conceptual questions, procedural questions, and metacognitive questions. So, and then the circle approach, you can use the same questions and the different theories, and as you get into the to the dense aspect, you have a question about using the CEDAR app to calculate postoperative morbidity for a patient with a hernia. That gets brings all of the circles together. So now I'm going to change just a little bit and talk about not the structure of the questions, but actually how to use them both to study as well as to assess, or both formative and summative. So there are kind of two approaches to learning new knowledge. One is to study or read, and the second is to use questions. They're obviously not mutually exclusive, although some tend to either just read or just use questions, and it turns out that the best, no surprise, that the best way to learn is to have some combination of studying or reading interspersed with questions. Now, you can use those questions in a couple different manners. You can do all of your reading and then take a test. So study, take a test every 10 years. Or you can ask the questions in intervals. And it turns out that asking questions in intervals is a much, much more effective way of learning knowledge, assessing in a formative, from a formative framework. There's also a fair amount of literature on the type of questions. And it turns out that multiple choice or recognition questions are tend to be lower on the ladder, further out in the circles. And that doesn't test knowledge nearly as well. Questions that are written in a way to retrieve knowledge, that are short answer or require you to retrieve some and apply some piece of knowledge or piece of data, are much more effective in retention. So if we would ask you a multiple choice question and then ask you again in 6 months, you're not likely to remember the answer. But if we asked you a question that required retrieval and asked you again in 6 months, you are much more likely to remember the answer. So the question type, in addition to spacing, makes a difference. And feedback as well. So you need to know why you got the question correct, as well as why you might have gotten a question incorrect. So you're not just studying one thing, right? You're studying multiple things. And it turns out that interleaving is a better way of using questions to learn. So if you have three things to learn, things A, B, and C, rather than, so now you know you need to study a little bit, answer some questions. If we've done a good job, the question should be higher on the ladder and they should be more retrieval type questions. You should have a question A and then B, C, A, B, and C rather than all A, all B, and then all C. So interleaving from a formative standpoint results in better knowledge retention. So the practice of retrieval is one of the theories that continuous certification is based on. So if you're retrieving something frequently, you're more likely to use it. So if you think back to your phone number when you were young, when you actually had to remember phone numbers rather than just have it in your phone, you had to retrieve that number so many times. It's burned in your memory. It's because of the retrieval that it is burned in your memory. So this every 2 years really came from the practice of retrieval. So the learning process, the formative aspect of this new certification, you read, you study, you answer some questions, you get feedback about whether you got the question right, why you got the question wrong. You read for understanding, particularly those questions that you didn't get right, and then repeat the question. And it turns out to really be as basic as this. This is the best. If there is a recipe for learning, this is the recipe. Using questions is better than solely restudying. So rather than just going to read, you actually do need to go through the process of answering the questions again. Essay or short answer questions are truly better than multiple choice. I'm not sure we're there yet, but that's ultimately using some natural, if we could do this process with some natural language processing, that would be the best way to both learn and assess. And doing it in an interval standpoint, in an interval way, is better than all at once. So 2 years truly is better, both from a learning and summative assessment, than all at once. So the every 2 years rather than every 10. So in summary, trying to stay out of the gotcha questions, the recall questions, the lower order, sequencing or interleaving is very important. varying the knowledge dimensions as important, and ultimately probably spacing and retrieval are the most important. So I'd like to thank Mark and Pat for the opportunity, and happy to answer any questions on the panel.
Thank you. Audience, it's time for your questions. There is a microphone over on that side. If you would please use it to ask any questions, identify yourself and where you're from. And maybe I can ask the panelists to begin and talk, just sort of taking off on the aging surgeon questions. A question for the audience first. How many of you have some sort of a policy at the institution or practice you work in that relates to increased assessment of aging surgeons, whether it's a particular age or whatever? Anyone? One, two, three. It's clearly a minority. Panelists, what do you think about that? Should we be doing mandatory testing at a certain age, or should it be based on something else?
When we took this up at a local credentials committee, the issue was we could not find data to say what age, and we couldn't find what assessment. And so other than saying see your physician, see your personal physician, there wasn't much guidance.
So I would say to piggyback in on Karen's comment, needs further study. As a part of a different talk, I think age diversity is important. So I actually think that young people, young surgeons and older surgeons have complementary strengths and weaknesses. And so I think it's having that mix in a department, in a practice group is important. I would favor treating the older surgeons, which I guess I'm technically one, as similar, in that I think we need continuous evaluation. We need the things we've been talking about. That's why I think it's a good program. I think because problems do happen with young surgeons as well. It's not, as a matter of fact, whenever I talk about complementary strengths and weaknesses, there are some impairment issues that are more likely in young surgeons than older surgeons. So I think we do need continuous assessment. I think that should also be managed and done by surgeons, That's one of the reasons why, as Patrick said, I'm much more in favor of the boards doing that than other organizations. So I think that should be done by surgeons who are focused on what's the right thing to do for the patient.
The only thing we did was to look at what age perhaps you should quit taking call, because there is good data out there about sleep. And I must admit, most of my life I got 4 to 5 hours of sleep. And then I listened to a talk by Gene Crumley, who is a PhD out at UC Davis, about sleep and how much sleep one needs in order to think clearly and to not be upset with other people and to understand the limitations of what you're about to do. And as you age, you need more sleep, and you need to assess that. So I now need 7.5 hours of sleep. So if I go to bed at 10, I will wake up at 5:30 automatically, because we're old, we don't need alarms, right, to do it. And I think having people get enough sleep as you get older is important. So at Hopkins, at age 60, which I think a lot of practices do, the surgeons don't take night call anymore, and then you need to adjust that for all the reasons Ronnie said, because having a senior surgeon around for younger surgeons in ORs, it really has changed so much. And when I came out, they said, go in there and good luck, and sink or swim, and no one helped you. And now it's just so wonderful that senior surgeons help their partners. They go into rooms, they sort of cruise rooms and help people, and they can do a lot more for you in assessment appropriateness, being chief medical officer, there's lots of things that a seasoned surgeon can do. And also, they could be the assessment surgeon. You know, they could be the one that are talking to your surgeon 60 and older about how their outcomes are and who's in the operating room with them to make it happen. But I think for us, the sleep thing, especially ED doctors too, you know, about how much sleep you get really does impair what you're doing much more when you get older, and assessing that sleep in yourself, I think, is really important. And then taking away the call, because there's no, not all people age the same, you know, to do it. And to just put an age mandatory, I think actually you would lose out some great surgeons, and also you probably would meet a lot of lawyers, you know, because there would be people saying, I can practice, and start having those conversations. The other conversation I have with young surgeons is to tell them to get financially okay by age 60, that they actually need to, whatever they do, you know, figure it out. I say, you know, you spend most of your life collecting stuff, and then you try to give it away, and nobody wants it. So don't buy so much stuff. They said the average doctor, by the time they get to 60, has only saved $500,000. $500,000 by age 60. And that shocked me, but that we spend everything. And part of it is, I think we deserve everything. But I think by age 60, if you're financially good, then if something happens like what happened with Ronnie, you're available and your family's safe. So you won't keep operating because you don't have any money. And I've seen that a lot, where people have less than $500,000 and they're still working because they're financially insecure. And that's not a good thing. And then at age 60, to have a plan that you might do something else. And frankly, I'm 63. I sort of started making a plan around 60 so I don't spend nights up doing ruptured aneurysms. I do thoracic outlet surgery, and I focus on other skill sets now in my 60s because I got tired. And I think part of that is the way you can monitor an older surgeon.
Right.
With respect to the call issue, I think the point is really valid. Although I would temper it, I think it should be, I think that should be at the discretion of the surgeon and the people they're working with. I have a colleague whose name's Fred Corley. He's really funny, and he's in his 70s now. Dr. Corley's an orthopedic surgeon, and he had a common little saying that he would say, you know, I wanted to take my boards at 2 a.m. because I knew I was the smartest, because nobody ever came in to help me at 2 a.m. So he wanted to take his boards at 2 a.m. because no matter how complex the problem, he was good as a resident at 2 a.m. In his training paradigm. So I'm going to say that I think actually senior experience is needed at 2 a.m. and 3 a.m. and 4 a.m. And actually I think that can be done if it's structured correctly in with that sort of mix of young people and old people. And the other problem with a solid cut point for that is it actually, think about when you were a student and resident. I mean, I realized over the period of a six-year time in residency that by the time I was a chief resident, I was tireder. It was more difficult whenever I was a chief resident compared to whenever I was an intern. So I think it's a continuum, and I think having that balance of youth and age is important probably at all hours of the day and night. So that's all I'd say.
Dr. Mualim.
Jacob Mualim from Rochester. And maybe my disclosure should be is that I agree with everything that you guys have said. I've been privileged to defend MOC at the AMA and in other places. But I do have a question. Going back to the stated goal of the board itself, which is protecting our public from bad surgeons, I wonder if you would comment on the discriminating ability of this process versus the local credentialing boards and committees. There was a story that came out of Texas, I think last week or the week before, of a neurosurgeon who bounced around four or five different hospital systems in a very short period of time, leaving a trail of destruction in his wake. And it just seems to me that we have a lot of other tools that are not being optimally utilized in this regard. We have access to real-time data of outcomes. And How do you see the relationship between those types of tools and MOC evolving over the next few years?
Pat, do you want to start?
Well, I can't necessarily assess how it's going to evolve, but everybody in this room knows, and it's the elephant in the room, is that we can't test competency on a piece of paper. I think the person that probably has the greatest ability to determine the competency of surgeons is the program director when they sign off for that resident and when they finish. They're the only one that really, really knows that's in the system that can say they're competent. That and then people that you work with. And so that's the purpose of the two letters that you get in part one from chief of staff, et cetera. Unfortunately, those letters tend to be biased by they know the person too well and they're not going to write something negative, or they're biased by some he threw an Ochsner clamp at me 12 years ago and it barely missed me and I'm still ticked off. And so it's hard to get honest evaluations, and everybody in this room evaluates people and they very seldom say what they really think. I'll just say that. But the people that know how you operate are the people that see you every day. I'll bet you that the circulating nurses at your hospital know who the best surgeons are better than virtually anybody else there. And so if we're going to really get down to who's competent skills-wise, we're going to have to get down to something, and it may even be more than just results. I mean, results are hard to tell. I mean, we all have surgeons at our hospitals that take care of just crazy patients or crazy clinical problems that are very difficult, and they don't get good results. And they don't get good results because they're taking care of somebody that's sicker than somebody else. Of course, we all think we take care of the sickest patients. So I still think that that is the big elephant, is we don't have abilities to say who's competent technically and who has judgment at the scene very well. We can test some cognitive knowledge, and we're moving to do better, but we still have a big gap.
Well, and I'll touch that because I sort of said that in my talk. You know, it's a person that checks all boxes and those that don't. We do need to tell the truth. I have hired a couple people that I have called back and said, should I hire this person? And I did, and the answer should have been no. And sometimes we do that because we really want them to go away. We want them to leave our institution. Two, we're a little scared about medical legal issues. But actually, Dick McCann taught me the best one. When I called him once about somebody, I said, should I hire him? And he just said, nope. I said, anymore else? He goes, nope, and that's all he said. So that you actually, when they said, what did he say? Not much, you know, to do it. But I think we need to tell the truth. I do agree. I have called the head nurse of operating rooms, and I have found the head nurse, and I said, would you tell me about this surgeon? And one or two things happen. Either there's a pregnant pause, and it just sits there, and you know you just found out, or they go on and on how much they love him and they don't want him to leave, him or her to leave. And it's fabulous. And I have done that. That's better than even going to watch people operate, because I think they will choose amazing things. I read that whole article. It was just a nightmare. And there are people we train that look really good when they're with us, that go out and really feel, and I think that's the young curve, that they can do anything. And I remember some cases I did not do well as a young surgeon. I thought I could do it as well, or I overestimated, or the appropriateness, or I didn't follow up fast. I mean, there is a learning curve, and that's why the senior partner is so important. But I think we do need to tell the truth. I do think it is your local board that you have to be honest about that. And I have exited probably about 10 surgeons over my life who are not good surgeons. Some of it was clinical. Some of it was behavior. Most of it was both. And I think the piece I would tell you is if you are going to be a very good provider of care and a competent surgeon, you will fill every box. You will do your MOC. You will get your license. You won't let it expend. You will do your quality metrics. You will show up at clinic. You will get your notes done. I mean, you will just be a complete person, just like that you were the patient. But I do think we have to tell the truth, you know, and I think we do. When you see that, we really need to talk about it. And the last thing, the elephant in my room, is if someone is making a lot of money for you in your hospital and they are a bad behavior, or there's bad outcomes, or there's inappropriate. We did that at one of our small hospitals in our system. An orthopedic surgeon who kept that hospital alive, but when we assessed his indication for intervention, we felt 40% of his practice, he shouldn't have been operating on those people. So we asked him to leave. Now, he went to another hospital, but we actually made it very clear that he couldn't be part of us. And I just did that with another surgeon who did a lot of procedures in his office, and we couldn't monitor them and made lots of money. But you really need to get away from the money piece and really look what's going on. And it's hard, you know, because these people also, if they make lots of money, people really like them for all the wrong reasons. And it's really hard. And they do know lawyers. But I think you got to make those big decisions. And that's why go be the chief medical officer, go be the chief operating officer, run hospitals, go be a CEO, go run stuff. Because I actually think we have less tolerance for bad behavior and bad outcomes than most other specialties.
So let's go on to the next question, if we could.
So I have two questions. One is real quick.
Can you identify yourself?
Dan Clark from outside of Pittsburgh, Indiana, PA.
Thanks.
If you currently have your certification through whatever year, is it still that you don't have to take the mock until that time? Or do you have to, because there was a question, 2020 it was going to start that you had to start taking it. I'm certified through 2025.
You know. So I think for the American Board of Surgery, at least what's happened is if you have a certification that's intact the future year, you just mentioned 2025, that remains.
Okay.
That does not change.
All right. And the second question I have is about aging surgeons. I was actually just recruited to be the chief at a system, and taking over, there were two older surgeons there, and the issue of call. And you talked about, you know, not taking call, but I have younger surgeons who don't want the extra call. You know? So how do you balance that when you have an older surgeon who, you know, I'm there 4 months and I'm dealing with emails why we're here about a surgeon who went to the chief medical officer and said he doesn't want to be on call anymore, you know, because there was an issue where he didn't cover a patient on call. You know, and it came to my attention. I took it up to the chief medical officer, and his response was, well, I'm old. I don't want to take call anymore. Yet I talked to younger surgeons. They don't want any more call. So how do you make that fair if they're operating during the day, taking the cases from the younger surgeons? You know, they're doing that elective gallbladder hernia or whatever, and yet you make the younger surgeons carry the call burden. See, I'm in the in-between. I'm sitting there looking at if you're going to do elective cases during the day and you're competent to do those during the day, then you probably should be participating in the call schedule as well. Otherwise, retire, don't do cases, so that the younger surgeons can build their practices and get the experience, and we can recruit another surgeon to take your place and take call. So I just was interested in your theories on that.
Yeah, so there's the balance question, right? You know, how do you create that balance and not overburden?
I think you're in the best position to make that assessment. By that I mean the person who's there. I think I've walked the walk on this. I hope I have. I'm just say what. So about 25 years ago, we created, Dr. Oust created a trauma and acute care surgery service, where basically the trauma and acute care surgery service took all the really what you would consider ER call acute care patients. And so that left a group of surgeons who were really doing elective practice. This is a different practice saying than you're in, right? But I would say that extended the career of those elective surgeons by a decade. It extended them to a period of time where they could, because they weren't taking all those things. And the trauma service is not covered only by young people, but by a lot of young people doing that. Now, that trauma service is well compensated for that as well. So I think you have to look in how is that being compensated. In other words, I'm just saying these are the things that you have to try to balance with respect to it. But ultimately, I think it is a local decision where you're in the best position to do that. And maybe they should be taking call. And if you can't take call, if you're not capable of taking call at that time because of the factors that are mentioned, then, you know, maybe that's not the right practice anymore. But I don't mean to be – Right. It's a complex decision, right? It's not simple, black and white. I guess that's why you're asking us.
Right.
Maybe
also,
we get some wisdom from the panel.
Well, and also in smaller hospitals, it's hard. You know, in a big academic center, you turn 60, you start. I really think you need to start having these conversations with surgeons at 60, because if you wait till they're 75, you know, it's late to decide a plan, you know. So having conversations at 60, just like I ask my surgeons every year, have you gone to the doctor? The number of doctors, male surgeons specifically, women tend to go a little bit more because they've had children or have gone. But most of my surgeons hadn't seen a doctor since they were in football practice when they were 18, you know. And I had a few have heart attacks and all sorts of stuff. So I did get permission to require them to have a physical every year. And one guy brought me the paper to see it. I didn't want that. I don't want to see the whole H&P. I just want you to go. So in smaller hospitals, we have that in rural North Carolina. So who is going to do it? So some people shouldn't take call because they don't wake up or they don't come in or they punt. And so that actually is bad. It's hard to pay them in smaller hospitals because you don't – what is pay to do it? One I saw that worked really well in Washington is they hired people to just be the night people. So there are some people that want to work part-time. Some of them are women, some men, but they want to work two or three nights a week, and they'll do your call, or they'll do your cleanup batter, where they'll come in on Monday and do all the cases that are pending from the night before so your elective guy can do it. So you can get a little creative. The young people have to take call. I think that's the thing that's really hard. And now a third of them are partnered with another surgeon, so you get a couple, right? You get two people in the same household taking call, and then that gets really confusing to do it. But I think assessing that and making sure in the contract that you have something there to do it. But the small hospitals are hard because if you don't have someone take call, your hospital could close, you know, and so you really need to have them happen.
Maybe you could contact. You were in small hospitals all the time. You took call for like 10 years, didn't you, all by yourself?
30.
He knows this better.
40 or 50,
30
right?
Christmas, I'm guessing. 30 Christmas days. It was really easy in our hospital to know when I was on call. It was if I was in town. But we didn't run into this problem because right before our hospital closed, we were down to about 7 docs, but only one was under 60. So I guess everybody wanted to look at that clause that said you get to retire at 60. Well, if we didn't have the people over 60 taking call, nobody was going to. So I can't answer your question. I think doctors are always on call the rest of their life.
Yeah, we have 3 out of 6 surgeons who meet that qualification. So, you know, that would kill the practice in the hospital. And we don't have a trauma system
right. So, it's a vexing problem. I'm going to have to stop our question and answer period.